One thing that I didn't do the other day when we were doing introductions, members, is that I forgot probably the two most important people in the room as far as introductions, and that is our staff. And Jim Keller is our committee administrator. And Jim, I don't know if you want to tell us anything about you, about yourself, or if you want to pass on that, but I took him by surprise because he didn't know I was going to do that.
That's all you need to know.
Okay. That's all we need to know. And his business, his background is in business, and he has also been was an administrator last session for the Education Committee, as a position he holds again this session. And during the session, our committee administrators are actually doubling up. So he has two pretty exciting committees. And then our committee assistant is Kelly Whiting, and Kelly is new to us this year, I believe. And so, anyway, we welcome you both, and thank you very much for being here and for your hard work on behalf of the committee, and so that we can get our work done. Appreciate that. Okay, when last we met, we were going to finish up with the Secretary of State's office, because we didn't quite get through everything, and so we have Chuck Hibner and Kathy Polino to come back with us. And what I had planned is probably no more than about 30 or 40 minutes to finish up with their presentation and questions that they may have, and then members, we're going to move into a kind of an informational meeting with regards to the audit that was done on the OUS payroll increases from last interim. But for now, I would like to turn it back over to Kathy and Chuck to go ahead and continue on. And did you need the overheads back?
No.
Okay. Great.
So, Chuck Hummel, members of the committee. Chuck Hibner with the Audits Division. What we'd like to do to continue our presentation is, in the package that we had handed out, there is, I think it's attachment 4, where we have audits in process, update on audits in process. What I thought I might do is just take you through that quickly to get you up to speed on what we've got going.
Okay.
First of all, I'd like to say that we do have this particular document now on our internet website. That's at www.sos.state.or.us. If you go to the audits section, just click on the current audit projects and status tab. That'll give you a choice between performance audits, IT audits, financial audits, and you can go and select your favorite audit to find out where the what the status is. Part of the rationale behind having that available is we do often receive questions as to what's going on with audits, so we thought we'd try to make that more user-friendly. The sort of information we have contained in these reports really amounts to most of the information we can share when an audit is in process. Typically, we don't share more than the audit, the objective, the scope, and the methodology, the particular audit findings or conclusions. We do not share while an audit is still in process. That cannot be shared until a report is released. So what we do try to do is give as much information while an audit is in process as we possibly can, try to give you a projected release date and such. So if you like, I'll just go through the performance audit projects and kind of briefly touch on those and kind of where we are. With those projects. You see the first one on there, the multi-agency review of metered equipment, gives you a description there. We expect the report to be at the end of January. We're collecting audit responses as we speak. In fact, the Oregon University System we just received their response. There's 5 or 6 other agencies involved, and they're coordinating a response through DAS. And as soon as we get those responses, we'll include those in the report and release the report.
Excuse me, and DAS again is?
Department of Administrative Services.
That's good.
I went to the ATM.
Yeah, I did go to the ATM before.
You can when we're done, you.
You can I prepaid for three others.
Make the deposit in the piggy bank here.
Okay. Good catch. The second report we've got on there is a review of prior charge-offs, which we expect to release that report in mid-February. And that audit is really a data mining exercise where we're taking wage information and matching it with those particular receivables that have been deemed uncollectible and charged off, and just seeing if there's any potential for collecting those. So we expect to have that released in mid-February. We also have the third item there, the pharmaceuticals purchasing with the Department of Human Services. That particular audit is in report writing, and we will be releasing that one hopefully in mid-February. Follow-up on kindergarten through 12 education spending. We are near end of field work on that. We expect to be able to get into report writing here fairly shortly, and that, again, will be a February product. University system and community colleges printing and mailing. We are in the report writing process on that one, and that will be released in February. The Oregon Department of Transportation, our review of engineering services. We are in report writing on that one as well, and we'll expect that one to be released sometime early in March. Our Oregon Pharmacy Benefit Managers Processing of Medicaid Prescription Drug Claims and Payments. That is a mouthful, number one, but it also is a contracted audit. It's in response to a budget note we received last session where there was interest in our doing an audit of the Pharmacy Benefit Administrator, the entity which is a contracted entity that manages all of the pharmacy benefit payments for the Medicaid program. So we contracted with that. The Moss Adams, the contracted auditor, is doing the work as we speak. In fact, they're flying back to Virginia and Arizona to make sure they can get a good feel for the computer processes, and then they'll come back with the report by end of March. Department of Corrections review of inmate health care. That one we're just entering report writing. It's kind of quasi report writing field work. There's still some odds and ends we're still trying to get some follow-up information on. Therefore, we probably won't have that ready actually to release until the end of March. Department of Transportation, and this will probably cost me a quarter OTIA 3. Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Act. We are currently in field work on that one, and we expect a midsummer release on that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dingfelder.
I have a question about that, if I may.
You bet.
Sure.
I sat on the Transportation Committee along with Representative Brown last session, and it came to light, I think it actually was during the interim, that they're actually, I think it was based on work that OSU or was it University of Oregon did, some modeling that they did that showed that there actually might be ways to repair versus actually replacing the bridge. So is that what this is attempting to address, is whether the bridges that were slated for replacement actually needed to be replaced versus using the technology that was mentioned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, the purpose of this particular audit is in many ways to take a look at that. We're really interested in the process behind the list of bridges, mm-hmm. and that's really where our view is going to center on, is whether the process that got from the beginning to the list is appropriate and reasonable.
Okay. I got a follow-up. And this is not directly related to that problem, but it's related to contracting under OTIA. And one of the things that I talked to the Director of Department of Transportation about was contracting procedures under OTIA. And if we've already described the acronym, do I have to spell it out every time?
No.
Okay, thank you.
No.
I want to read
that. That was something I meant to add. We're going to use the written rule, which is once, and then after that you can use the initials.
However, what I'm getting at with this question is I'm interested to find out, do you do audits on contracting procedures for WBE, Women Business Enterprises, and MBE, Minority Business Enterprises, as far as under the OTIA contract? In other words, you know, one of the things that I talked to ODOT about is making sure that they're being more aggressive in subcontracting to those types of firms, looking at that. And so I'm wondering, do you do any audits on that as part of the OTIA process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, the OTIA program in and of itself, we're seeing potentially three different audit areas, one being this, one being just a contracting audit under the program, and we would expect that at some point we'd be interested in that, and then the payments themselves. So it's very possible that when we do an audit of contracting under OTA 3, that there will be some compliance issues we may want to look at. That we have in the past when we've done contracting audits, looked at compliance with the Oregon Women in Business Association rules and making sure that they're posting them within the 5 days, I think, or on the whatever the rules happen to be. So we have done that in the past, and that certainly could be a potential area of interest as we're looking at contracting practices, especially if it's specifically an area of interest when the rules were passed for the OTA 3.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Brown, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like this to be auditing the OTIA program at this time is awful early in the process. They're just barely getting off the ground in the repair work on the bridges and in the contracting. So it's hardly into even a year into the program now. And it's a 10-year program that some of the warts that you might find won't become visible until you're later, further down the road.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, that's why we view it kind of as a three-part process. The processes that go into selecting the bridges that are to be repaired or the decisions underlying those certainly would be a process that has been completed or is in the process or near completion, or if the process is a continuing process, then that process has been determined that's going to be a continuing process. So we certainly feel there's some value to getting an understanding of the process during this period. And then certainly once they start building and expending money and hiring contractors doing that probably is one of those things that we will keep a continual eye on, and at some point we'll indeed audit the contracting and the payments as well, because you can't audit those until, of course, they've been expended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. The next page, we have the review of gasoline purchase and use. We're still in the kind of the survey planning phase of that audit, trying to determine if there's an audit there that we want to do. At the end of the survey, if we come up with an objective and an audit plan, then we'll launch into that and hope to have a report out midsummer. We've got the Oregon Youth Authority Senate Bill 1 review that we just started. It, again, is in the survey planning phase, trying to determine what objectives we want to undertake when we do this project. And that, again, we reported sometime into the summer. The Public Defense Services and the Oregon Judicial Department Indigent Defense Survey, pretty much done our planning. We've got some potential objectives. We'll be updating this shortly. We'll be launching into field work, and we expect to have our report on indigent defense by the end of September, end of the summer. Facilities management, we're well into field work on that, and late summer we would expect to have a report on that. And Department of Human Services, Medicaid payments for personal care. I don't know if mine just got cut off or. Okay. Well, there we go. We are just in this beginning early survey on that, and we will we would expect an audit product to be out at the end of fall. On our information technology page, the first two, the Oregon Department of Transportation General Controls Review and the Department of Corrections Accounting and Manufacturing Information System, also known as AFAMIS. Both those reports were released on Friday, so they'll be coming off this list. Two other projects we do have in process. We're wrapping up the work at the Department of Human Services on their client maintenance system, and that is in report writing. And then the Department of Justice criminal child support enforcement automated system is in field work. We would expect that to be out late spring. And then our financial audit work, which is the next section. We have been releasing audit reports hot and heavy. This really is the wind down of our financial audit season, and we're getting out our opinions. The comprehensive annual financial statement for the state has out right?
Mm-hmm.
So that one was a big one. That's one of our major projects, and that one has been released. We've got some other small projects on there from the audit resource management audit of judicial department service and supplies, which was put on hold. So most of the staff went to the statewide audit project, so they'll be picking that up shortly. We've got some other work going on at the Columbia River Gorge Commission, which is joint with the state of Washington, Office of Energy and Economic Development. We've got some financial audits going there. And then the contracted financial audits kind of gives you a sense for some of the contract work we do. We've got the Appraiser Certification Board and Landscape Contractors Board. And then financial compliance audits. We're doing a cost allocation plan review at the Department of Administrative Services, and that one is currently in field work, and expect that to be out the end of February. And then the Measure 66 review, the biannual review of expenditures under Measure 66, which in report writing, but we are waiting for some information, opinion, mm-hmm. back from Department of Justice on some of the expenditures we're reviewing as to whether they're compliant with the intent. We expect that to be out in mid-March. And then the change of director reviews, you can see those listed here, Oregon University System, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and Water Resources Department, all three in field work. And those go fairly quickly, so we expect those to be out end of February, not sooner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder?
Thank you. I have a question regarding agencies like OWEB, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and OECDD, Economic Development. Both of those agencies give out grants to local governments and nonprofits and SWCD, Soil and Water Conservation District. How does your audit process work when a grant is handed off to another entity? Do you go in and audit to make sure that that grant is being used for the purposes, or do they have to do an independent audit and present that back to the agency to you? And I know that they give out hundreds of grants probably a year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I don't believe there's a specific audit requirement in the grants that they are giving out. That's my understanding. We certainly find that out for you. So we have done reviews in Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, especially Measure 66 expenditures, and specifically the grants and how they're granting them and their oversight of grants and ensuring that the money's being spent as intended. So from a systemic point of view, we do look at Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and how they're managing their grants and how they are getting the information back that they would need in order to ensure that the expenditures are monitored and appropriate and those sorts of things.
And what about OECDD? Because they have a local, I think it's mostly local governments that the grants are going to, or maybe economic development agencies as well. Is it a similar process for OECDD?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, what we're doing at Economic Development is looking at two specific bond programs that they have, and we're issuing opinions on those. So these are financial statement opinion audits as far as those go. We haven't looked at, in that case, specific grants, but we do have the authority, if there is a question about a grant, we could follow the grant money all the way down to the recipient to see how it is used. So that is within our authority to do if we have some questions or concerns.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, we have, it's been a couple of years, but we did actually go into economic development and do a risk assessment that did look at systemically some of the things that they have in place for monitoring their grants, and just kind of looking at the processes evaluating the risk in anticipation of whether or not there would need to be audit work there. So we could potentially provide that.
That would be interesting seeing that, Mr. Chair, if we could.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'll make a note. Certainly, Jim, we'll make a note of that and follow up on that, please. Okay. Are there other questions for... I'm sorry. Did you have... Is that pretty much it?
Mr. Chair, that's my update.
Okay. Are there any other questions for either Kathy or Chuck? A couple of things that I've noted here. First of all, if we go back to on the financial audits page of attachment 4, the in-house financial audits, I'm trying to... I'm trying to understand, I guess, what these are going to determine based on the description that's written here. For the Columbia River Gorge, it says, purpose of the study is to determine if the financial statements of the organization are fairly presented in all material aspects. The second one with the Office of Energy, and I don't know what SELP stands for, but of the SELP program, the purpose of this audit is to determine if the financial statements of the organization are fairly presented in all material aspects. And then with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, Special Public Works Funds, and the, what's the WF, must be... something fund, water fund. The purpose of this audit is to determine if the financial statements of the organization are fairly presented in all material aspects. I'm trying to understand what fairly presented in all material aspects means. I mean, is that dealing with accuracy? Is that dealing with, yes, we can see the amount of money coming in and the amount of money going out, and there is a balance there, and there's the intended and necessary reserves, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, to say that it's fairly presented in all material aspects, you can hand somebody a piece of paper and say, well, it's fairly presented because anybody can look at it. Mm-hmm. So I need a little help understanding what that means.
Sure. Mr. Chair, this is a financial statement opinion audit, and what we are doing is we're looking at how the statements are presented to see whether they do comply with the generally accepted accounting principles. So what we do that work is we look in each of the specific categories that are in the financial statements and, you know, just take a look at maybe assets. And we'll do some audit tests to look at, you know, what is actually recorded in each of those accounts to make sure that they do what's recorded is what should be recorded in each of those accounts, and that the amounts are accurate, so that when somebody is picking up that opinion audit, they can rely on the financial information that's within that report. Yes, it is stated fairly according to accounting principles. So, and that's the extent of what a financial statement opinion does, is it really tells you if the information is materially accurate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Let me see if I can get at your question a different way with Kathy, if I may.
Please.
Typically, accountants work on the basis of statistical samples. And a statistical sample of 95% gives you a certain confidence level. Do you employ the statistical sample process in this, in the financial audits that you're looking at? And what is the confidence factor that you're looking at? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we'll have to get that from Mary, who's the deputy over financial audits. But I know that in a lot of cases it is your 95% confidence level. But it really depends upon the fund that they're looking at. And you may use a statistical sample for one, and one may not be. You may be able to sample 100%. So. It really would kind of depend, but you're right, the statistical sampling is a large part of what we do, and the confidence level is something we do.
Mr. Chair, if I might just elaborate on that a little bit. So rather than sample every account to the degree of 100%, which has been done evidently in some performance areas where you're looking for the exceptions, if you had a sample size, population, total population of 2,000, you could draw a statistical sample that would give you a number of and I'm not going to be able to use the actual words that you use in statistics, but when they draw from that 2,000 population, if they'll draw a total of perhaps 100 examples, that 100 would be a lot on a population of 2,000. But if they find any variance within whatever the population size that they have to have a 95% confidence, then the 95% confidence level, if there's a variance, if there's a defect in one of those instances that they have selected, then they no longer have, they're going to have to increase the size of the sample amongst the population in order to maintain that 95% accuracy or 95%
confidence that all of the issues that are presented are 100% accurate. So typically, again, and that's what's done by the accountants out in the field that are giving the original financial audit, the opinion on the original financial audit, out of a population of 100,000 checks issued by a county, for instance, they may sample, out of 100,000, they might sample 500 checks for certain fields in the checks, and then the detailed documentation behind those checks. Once they have determined that of the 500 checks, all of them meet the requirements. They were properly dated, they were properly signed, they were properly written to the payee, and they were properly endorsed on the back by the payee, and that they had the adequate invoices that supported the original payment, that it had been approved, that it had gone through the vetting process of the original invoice, then at that particular point, the accountant is going to come back and say, I am confident that their internal controls are such that 100% of those checks are materially accurate. And then what happens is that now we're taking a sample from a different, from the population of the items on the balance sheet and the profit and loss, if you will, the operating statement that is provided to the state by the independent auditors. That, and this will make you go blind eventually if you do it long enough. But,
is that why you have the glasses?
Yeah, right. But what happens then is they then draw from that population. And they say, we're now going to seek a sample size of the issues on the financial statements, and if they are correctly presented amongst our sample, then we're going to tell you that 95%, we're confident, and confident in this case is a 95% confidence level. We're not going to tell you that with regard to the financial statements that we're presenting, that we're clearing and authorizing to be finalized, that they are 100% accurate at all times. We're going to say that they're accurate in all material respects, and that's the same thing that the accountant does. He doesn't, or he or she doesn't, back when the original audit is given, doesn't say that one of the invoices could have lacked all of the necessary detail. One of the authorization, the purchase orders, wasn't signed off by the department or by the employee and the department head to say, yes, we need it, yes, it's within our budget. Somebody failed to initial or tick one of those underlying documents. And so that would be an error. And had it been found within the population, had it been discovered, or had it been a subject of sample, then there would have been an increase in the size of the sample, or they would have to determine whether or not that was in the statistical probabilities of the 95% that they were willing to originally waive on. If it isn't a material error at that point, or if they can come back and look at the invoice and say, we have an invoice approved by the manager. The internal controls are such that the manager could not have originated that document in and of themselves. They have gone back and determined the internal control in that particular issue, in that particular department, was still adequate, and that is really not an exception. Then they come back through the process. So I guess when you talk about all material aspects, that these are presented fairly and accurately in all material aspects, we're saying that we're not going to tell you that there isn't a single error anywhere in the entire field. What we're going to say is that we believe that as to 95% of the time, everything is working absolutely perfectly.
Okay. And that's just dealing with material aspects and not necessarily dealing with
Mr. Chair, if
factual.
I can presuppose your question. If the cash account says that there is $120,000 cash on hand, then they will be able to tell you that is accurate. in all material aspects that cash account is properly presented. Probably one of the things that we deal the most with in these audits, because of some of the GASB pronouncements that we were talking about the other day, the Government Accounting Standards Board, I think that's what GASB is, the GASB and more particularly these more current pronouncements have demanded that we have complete balance sheets with the asset lists, the complete asset lists. In the past, we didn't have those detailed asset lists with the depreciation attached to them. We weren't required to. Whether or not we had a sweeper truck working on the streets of the county that was fully depreciated or brand new made very little difference. And so this has been one of the areas that I'm sure that it probably has been I know that for the accountant out in the field, the independent accountants, the certified public accountants who are giving the original opinion, this is a very difficult item for them because what happens is that if you've got an item, again, 2,000 items in the field that you're examining, and maybe a 100 sample would be enough, what happens is that they'll come in and there's a call on whether or not the depreciation is accurate on that particular road grader. And so while they have to satisfy themselves as to the depreciation on the road grader, maybe that wasn't authenticated accurately and appropriately, and so then they have to increase the size of their population of their sample. They're not going to sample every garbage can in the building as to whether or not the chairs and desks and garbage cans have all been appropriately accounted for, but they'll do it as to the material aspects. Now, in the sample of the machinery and equipment, if your county had a gravel crusher and it was a $1 million item, you can bet that because it represents such a large portion of that single item on the balance sheet, you can bet that the work on the gravel crusher has been sampled and has been examined very thoroughly, and with regard to the detail on that, they're approving the accuracy and adequacy of the records and documentation and detail behind that, because that's a material portion of the balance sheet. Again, with regard to the financial audit, that again, it's an overseeing process. Now you're sampling, you're auditing the auditors, if you will, mm-hmm. at this particular point, the secretary that the state auditor is required to do. If you've got a single asset in that particular balance sheet that has that weighs heavier than any other, and I'm going to guess again, that's probably the fixed assets. For a city, I mean, they have enough cash to get along for a few months, but most of everything they've invested is in parks and transportation improvements, roads and streets and curbs and gutters and sidewalks and those kinds of things. And again, that's been probably the Gordian knot of what we're having to do in sampling these. And so when we talk about the material aspects, does the city or the county that you're coming through working on, or the other internal audits, what kind of assets do they have that are material, and then examining those assets and trying to determine which of those assets have the most weight on the balance sheet, and then can they give an unqualified opinion that, again, as to their opinion, and that's always 95% whispered back, because they're not going to tell you that everything is 100%. I've never seen a certified audit that said everything's 100% accurate, perfectly okay, and we will tell you that with no reservations. They will tell you that it is fairly presented in all material aspects.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation, Representative. I appreciate it. Are there any other questions for Kathy or Chuck with regards to their processes and that sort of thing? I do have a couple of comments, and this will come up again later when we're talking about the OUS audit. But at the point that you have gotten, once you've gotten to the point that your audit, your field work is done, and you're to the report writing. I would appreciate seeing a little bit more information in your description with regards to what the goals of the audit are, what the objectives of the audit are, what information you're looking for, and what are the queries that you launched to get to that information. And then that way, I think it will help. And I would also anticipate seeing that same information in the audit itself, because I think that it's important in terms of understanding what it is that you're going after. Because on some of these, I'm not sure that you've gotten to the report writing. Once you're at that point, it's no longer a surprise to anybody. And I know that you don't try to use the element of surprise other than from the standpoint of saying, we're coming in to audit you or we're here to audit you, because you don't want agencies trying to sort of, cover things up before they, if they know that they're going to be looked at. Everything should be transparent from the standpoint that they know they can be looked at any time on any day, and their information should be accurate and so on. But I think that helping us understand what it is that you're going after and have gone after is going to be, if that's in the description, it also helps us from a standpoint, and I think the general public, in determining whether or not they want to take the time to read a particular audit or not. Because maybe it's something that they're not, oh yeah, you did an audit on the pharmaceutical purchasing of the Department of Human Services. Okay, great. But I don't see anything here that tells me that it's really anything that I might be interested in taking a look at, as far as, whether the state's paying too much money for drugs or not enough money for drugs or whatever the case may be. So I think that's something that I would like for you to keep in mind.
And Mr. Chair, on all of this, timing is everything with regards to what information we put out. One thing I do want to note, and you can maybe see this using the report we're going to talk about later as an example, each one of our audit reports, when they go out, both have a summary section which talks about what the purpose of the report is and a high level what the results in brief are. Mm-hmm. But then also what our audit standards require is each report has what's called a scope and methodology section, mm-hmm. which talks about and really lays out the scope of the work that we did to come to our conclusions and the methodologies. Who did we talk to? What kinds of analysis did we do? So that a reader could look at that section of the report and see the length and the depth of work that we put into each audit report. And so you'll find that section within each one of our audit reports, so you can always kind of tell in a lot more detail exactly what steps we did to come to our conclusions.
Okay. Any other questions for Kathy or Chuck on this issue?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Relative to the, these are policy option packages that the Secretary of State's office will present to probably General Government Ways and Means, and be Senator Dukes, I'm going to guess. One of the items that you're requesting is additional money for K-12 auditors, and the concern I've got there is that the comment, no resource for school district administrators to turn to if they have specific concerns about a business process. Are we certain that COSA and other school administrators and school financial, I think they have their own organizations, certainly municipal auditors have their own organizations, are we certain that there is no resource for school district administrators to turn to if they have specific concerns about business practices and processes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think that statement has to do with that there isn't really a mechanism established to do this. There are people that are out there willing to help, but there's no formal mechanism to provide some resources for them to turn to where they could actually get some help in certain areas.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that is the case with the Secretary of State's office not having the resource. I take umbrage with the statement that the resource does not exist and that we need to go to the general fund to see that the Secretary of State provides that, because I believe that while the resources may not be as evident to the Secretary of State's office for K-12 auditors and the local people in the local district who prepare the financials or who are doing business in the business offices of these districts, I believe that there probably are greater resources than what that statement that's in, and I haven't read the actual policy option package, but that will be for the Ways and Means folks to take further look at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other, I appreciate getting this list of your option packages, and we'll take that up again at another time. With that then, I'm going to close the informational meeting on, or hearing on, the background information, audits 101. I'm going to open a review of audit number 2004-32, which is referred to as the Oregon University System, or OUS, Review of Payroll Increases. And Kathy, you want to go ahead and kind of introduce that for us, and who's going to present the information from the Audits Division, please?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Again, the report is number 2004-32, and it's titled The Oregon University System Review of Payroll Increases. And joining us up here is Sandy Hilton. She's one of our audit managers that was overseeing this particular project. Just wanted to give you a little bit of background information on this report before I turn it over to Sandy, how we even got involved in this. This was an issue that came to us through our hotline. We received an allegation that the university system was using something called reclassifications in order to change position classifications and kind of get around the wage freeze that took place during the 2003-2005 biennium. We have a really good working relationship with their internal auditor down at the university system. They have a very good internal auditor, and she's here today. We worked with her on that particular hotline call when it came in, and she took a look at that and concluded that there weren't any problems with that particular instance, and we concurred. We thought that she did a very good job on that. We did notice when we were looking at it, though, that there were some other increases in salaries that came out as we were looking at some of the data with regards to that allegation. And so we took a little bit closer look at that. One of the things we saw when we were looking at the data is that there appeared to be kind of department-wide increases in some of the salaries that we were looking at. So we had some discussions in trying to figure this whole thing out with the Legislative Fiscal Office. We spoke with them many times on this, trying to figure out what information was conveyed to the university system with regards to the salary freeze that took place. And we also had discussions with the governor's office trying to figure out, you know, well, what did you communicate to them with regards to their participation in the salary freeze. And we also took a look at some of the formal communications, such as the budget cuts that were provided to them. And one in particular on May 27th, the university system received this budget note that said, the adopted budget does not support any increases in salary, wages, or benefits for the employees of the department during the 2003-05 biennium. And the committee expects no such increases to be awarded. And so our audit work, we were looking at the obviously the 2003-05 salary freeze. And what we were noting in our report and all of the questionable increases that we can report are ones that we found no contractual obligation for the university to grant during this biennium. So all of these increases took place during the 2003-05 biennium, with the exception of 11 that we'll talk about. And then all of the approvals took place after this budget note was given to the university system. So the approvals came after that date. The increases took place during the 2003-05 salary freeze. And those are all the questionable ones that we talk about in this report. And so with that, I'll let Sandy go into the details of the report, and we'd be happy to answer questions on it.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Crumbo, members of the committee, for the record, as Kathy said, my name is Sandra Hilton. I'm an audit administrator here at the Secretary of State Audits Division. I'd like to recap this report for you and our key results from this report. The purpose of this audit was to determine if the pay increases granted by the university system were in compliance with the legislative intent of the 2003-2005 statewide pay freeze. One primary aspect of that freeze was not to grant any merit increases during the 03-05 biennium unless there was a contractual obligation to do so. Our review focused on payroll increases granted at two universities, the University of Oregon and Oregon State University. Although the pay freeze had been widely discussed before, we determined that the May 27, 2003 date was the date to use for our testing. The governor had stated his desire for the pay freeze even earlier during the January 10, 2003 budget message. Further, as Kathy had said, the Joint Legislative Ways and Means Education Subcommittee in late May had presented the university system with a budget note which included them in the pay freeze. And this note was introduced and adopted by the committee at a vote of 5-0. Thus, what we did is we limited our review to that May 27th date. During some previous legislative testimony given in December of 2004, there appeared to be some confusion over the number of payroll increases that occurred at the universities. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is give you some clarification on that, which I think will help out here. Near the beginning of our review, we had summarized some payroll data from the university payroll records. And we did this for 2 months, 1 month that was prior to the pay freeze, which was May of 2003, and one which was well into the pay freeze, which was November of 2003. What we found was that approximately 3,500 employees received an increase in pay of at least $50. We can't tell you how many of these increases...
Excuse me, Sandra, was that...
Chair Kimmel.
That pay increase, was that $50 for a year or $50 per month, or what was the basis for that?
Mr. Chair Krummel, what this is this was a comparison of just these 2 months. So if you looked at November 2003 and you compared it to May of 2003, we identified the same employees that had at least a $50 more pay in November per that month than they had the previous May.
So it could be surmised then that the increase for, and it was for 2,000 employees, you said?
Approximately 3,500 employees.
3,500. And so it could be surmised that it was $50 per month as opposed to $50 for a year.
Chair Krummel, that is correct. It would be at least $50, somewhere more than $50. But we had to set a threshold that we felt. So we selected a $50 threshold. If it was under $50, we did not select that. We have some software that we use for this, some automated software that helps us to do these kind of data matches and identify populations.
So establishing a $50 threshold, and what you're saying then is that some of the employees were higher than that and some of them were lower than that, but $50 was the threshold that you used. Do you have the data as far as how many were higher than and what the amounts were?
Chair Krummel, we can get that for you. I do not have those with me here today, but if you would be interested, we could get that for you.
That would be something that in the future you might want to bring information, you know, anticipate whatever question we might have and bring the information. Go ahead.
Okay. Of these increases, we couldn't tell how many were appropriate or not, but what we did do is we selected a sample of 73 increases, and we decided on these two universities, University of Oregon, Oregon State University, since they do have so many of the system employees. During this review, while we were reviewing the 73, we also identified an additional 142 items which were part of more departmental actions that we also reviewed. Although we may have liked to have been able to review the whole 3,500 instances, the amount of time necessary to review the payroll documentation really made it infeasible for us to perform that comprehensive of a review. There was quite a bit of work involved in reviewing these increases because we did go out and talk to officials at the universities and we reviewed a lot of documentation too associated with them. We also identified some coding problems in the data, how these increases in pay were been coded in the data in the university payroll system. So we didn't feel that it would be appropriate to try and project any results to the whole population of any increases. In total, we questioned 126 payroll increases with an estimated cost of over about $800,000 for the biennium. I would like to take a minute here to share with you some of the things that we did not question. We did not question any regularly scheduled merit increases that were given to classified or unionized staff prior to September 16th. There had been a union contract in place, and that union contract did not make it effective for one of the larger unions of the university until September 16th for the pay freeze. So if there were any increases that were between July 1st and September 16th, we did not question those with the, if they were regularly scheduled merit increases, I should say. If they were an extra meritorious increase,
One second, Representative Butler, you have a question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. Well, while Sandy was talking about the dates involved there, Sandy, I appreciate the fact that you've got certain dates cut off here, and I appreciate particularly the timeline which you've given us. But relative to the 126, did you go back and determine whether or not those were in process or had been open? Because if I've being in business myself personally, if I've told someone that they've got a raise coming in February, that they've got a raise coming, I can anticipate that we're going to be in negotiation for that raise for perhaps some time. Did you by any chance go back and examine the time that they had discussed the first, or had been what had been the common practice up to that point?
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, yes, we did. What we actually looked for, though, and what we had quite a bit of discussion about this, actually. It's not always an easy decision to make, but as auditors, we like to have documentation. So what we really hung our hat on this is we looked for documentation, and if it was documented prior to May 27th, which was at the time of the Ways and Means Committee and the budget note, if it had occurred prior to that, we did not question that particular raise. However, if it, you know, there could have been verbal agreements made or verbal communications, and that was not something that we're able to document and prove. So we did stick to written documentation that showed, and in fact, I have one here I'm going to go over in a minute that was quite that sort of a situation here that would explain that maybe a little bit better, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by way of follow-up, and that was the question that the agency's response was that in fact, that the documentation for the types of actions will shift to the employer specialist, from the employer specialist, employment specialist, to compensation director. So they recognized it, I think, as a shortcoming in the university system, and indicated that they were going to respond to that by tightening up some of their internal control.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, too, with the union, the classified staff, there were a few extra meritorious payroll increases. These would be increases that were given in addition to any regularly scheduled merit increases. Those we would question, and we did question a few of those. Not too many, but we did question a few of those. We also did not question raises that resulted from any written obligations made prior to May 27th. This is the exception here, was that there was one retained raise, which was supported by a memorandum. But the memorandum was dated October 1st, and it referred to an offer that was turned down in July. So since both of those dates were after our May 27th date, is why we included that one and questioned that one as well. There were others, like I said, that had been approved. There had been written memorandums prior to the May 27th date, which we did not question because of that reason. Finally, we also excluded any post-tenure reviews from our final questioned raises, and also any increases that were given as a result of promotions or reclassifications. Although approved prior to July 1st, 2003, all but 11 of the increases questions were effective July 1st or later. These exceptions to this, there were 11 increases that had been documented in a memo dated June 30th, 2003, and these were made retroactive to June 1st, 2003. So those did fall outside of being effective after the July 1st date. Most of the increases that we questioned were actions given to faculty and staff not covered by union contracts. These increases were at several departments and colleges. University officials had told us these raises with an estimated biennial cost of approximately $495,000 at the University of Oregon and $105,000 at Oregon State University were the result of normal university processes. I'd like to give you an example, though, of what we saw when we looked at these departmental increases. We had 13 departments and one college at the University of Oregon that granted increases that made up almost half of the amount that we questioned. And these increases were given to 70 faculty members. What we saw was lists of the employees' names, and there were some handwritten notes, initials, on the list that said that they were approved, and they were approved on May 28, 2003, and there was a statement handwritten on these lists that said previously planned and regularly scheduled merit. In addition to these increases, which made up really a fairly large percent of what we were looking at, we also identified departmental increases given to 17 individuals at the University of Oregon, which were funded by research grants. And while these funding for these increases was available through the grants, the grant documentation did not state that they had to be given, that they must be given. So we did review grant documentation. We were looking for to see, well, is there something in here that says that these increases should be given? In addition, there was our understanding, too, which in the testimony a little later on, we'll explain a little more, that this pay freeze was to apply also to any fund type is what our understanding was. So we didn't just limit it to one particular fund type. Less than 10% of the increases in question were given to 11 individuals for various reasons. And unlike these department-wide increases, these increases appear to be really isolating instances. And since they were not systemic, we didn't really consider them to be as significant to our report. One of the things that we did note in our audit was that the university system did not seem to have really a consistent message as far as regarding the salary freeze. And I have a couple of examples I'd like to give you, some of the documentation that we saw on this. For example, at the University of Oregon, University of Oregon's president on June 11th indicated it was not known how the salary increases for merit and retention would be treated. We also found as late as November of 2003 at Eastern Oregon University, there were some minutes of the Eastern Oregon University campus assembly that indicated that Eastern's administration had taken the view that, quote, merit was not part of the freeze, unquote. This was really in contrast to what we saw over at Oregon State University. Over there was a memorandum that was given that seemed to be pretty clear as far as implementation on the governor's pay freeze. This memo was dated July 1st, and it went to all senior executive administrators, deans, directors, and department heads, and it stated that consideration would be given for faculty salary adjustments due to reorganization or additional duties, but the memo went on to state that no request for any other type of salary adjustment would be reviewed unless a directive from the governor was received permitting such types of increases. The memorandum also stated that the instructions given apply to salary paid on all fund types, including grants, contracts, and other funds. So you can see why we went ahead and included the research grants in this, too. As I had stated previously, we did find this inconsistent coding in the data. In addition, as we were looking at personnel files, we did find that some of the personnel files, in particular in the chancellor's office, they did not follow best practices for documentation. So that concludes my presentation, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for your interest in our audits. And if you have any questions, I would certainly be happy to respond.
Are there questions for Mr. Chair?
This is scratching on some very fertile ground. First of all, I know that the audits committee or the prior audits committee in the interim has gone through this process, but as I recall, having worked in Ways and Means all of my history here in the legislative process, as I recall, we had a budget note relative to the state police and some other public safety issues. And that budget note was passed during a portion of the special sessions in 2002, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And that state police troopers were not to be cut, that certain areas of state police and other public safety areas were not to be cut, that we were extending resources and making those resources available. And I think that's why the timeline is important. And I'm sharing this with you because I just happened to remember that, and I just raked that that scab off that wound, if you will, as we've talked about this. The governor came back and told us the Ways and Means process, the legislature, that he was the chief executive officer, that he had no responsibility to pay one whit of attention to any of our budget notes, that they did not have the force or effect of being a mandate to the chief executive officer. Now, I submit to you, when the very trunk attached to the tendrils and the roots there below is telling you that they don't have to comply with these kinds of things, is it any surprise for any of us to question the reason when other agencies then come in and the branches start to shake just a little bit and saying, wait a minute, are we bound by these same kinds of dictates, particularly when these are not generally funded items? So in the context that within the prior 12 months we've had the chief executive officer of the state tell us, no, I am not bound by any of the kinds of things that you folks are telling me that I've got to do. I'm looking at this and saying, is it any wonder that we've got state agencies who are saying, this is not a generally funded item, this is a grant, this is a contract, this is other source, and if the governor of the state does not have to obey the direction in a budget note, which, and the governor's staff came back, as did the attorney general, I believe, and give us an opinion that budget notes do not have the force, effect, nor weight of law, and the governor, then governor, thumbed his nose at the legislative process and said, so I can spend the general funds how I want. And I just wanted to get that into the record, that the context of what another agency, a state agency that we had beginning in 1999 and a little before and mostly thereafter, had said, you're on your own. We're going to give you a certain amount of funds, and you're to work on an RAM, a resource allocation model, an entrepreneurial model. You go and do the very best that you can. And then I would also call your attention to a UP article that shows up in today's Statesman, I believe, that says something to the effect, how are you going to get appropriate professors in this state when we are underpaying them to the level that we're underpaying them? That's in today's Statesman Journal. University professors have to be brought in with the contracts and grants that they can bring with them, and then paid from those contracts and grants. So I just put that on the record because as I sat here and listened to this, I thought, you know what? I remember somebody else thumbing their nose at the legislative Ways and Means process. And who was it? It was the chief executive officer of the state of Oregon at that time.
Who, interestingly enough, had been a former legislator and tended to then decide to ignore the legislature. Interesting. Interesting perspective. And I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Might I ask Representative Butler a question then, too?
Yes, you may ask Representative Butler.
What you're saying then, Representative, is that the budget notes, by the opinion of a past governor and the attorney general, do not have to be any attention paid to them, that they don't.
Mr. Chair, it's my recollection that the then governor of the state of Oregon told us that the chief executive officer, the executive branch, And that would certainly include all of the agencies that are cut away, and certainly would be the Oregon University System, which we had dictated that had to be continue on with the resource allocation model of their entrepreneurial funds. They came back and told us they did not have the weight, the effect, nor the mandate of law behind them, that they were a suggestion. And so rather than the Ten Commandments, this becomes one of the Ten Suggestions, if you will. And we were shocked, we were disappointed, we were dismayed, because we had funneled funds that were to go to certain public safety aspects in the budget process. The governor said, the executive department does not have the responsibility to listen to these legislative suggestions, and they are legislative suggestions, so they're not law.
Do you know if the Attorney General opinion was it a written opinion?
Representative Brown, I don't recall that we have a written opinion. I do know that the governor's staff took a very, very strong opinion that the legislature could not, in a budget note, could not direct the governor to do anything with funds that had been appropriated. As long as it stayed within the mandate of the budget law, that weren't overspent or more than a certain amount shifted sideways, that at that particular point, that's where the governor had that latitude in the executive branch. And again, we're talking about an executive branch agency which is even one step further, at least one step further, away from the executive, away from the auspices of the legislative process, because these folks had been given the mandate that they were to go out and do with their funds as they saw fit. And we told them that. And at one point we said, you've got to go out and accomplish this and this and this. And they said, if you'll give us funds to do that, we can do that. But don't give us a mandate to do something. Don't give us a mandate to cross the Grand Canyon and then give us the funds to do it in two steps. You'll sink us. So it was then our responsibility to take a look at that and say, we're going to go ahead and give you these suggestions. And I don't want to minimize in this conversation the weight of what I saw then and what I see now today of a budget note. I think they are very important. They are certainly the legislative intent of what we would like to see happen. But I also, in the context of the time frame that's involved here, also can see that we've got folks that are saying, wait a minute, is that effective? And by Sandy's own admission, those fund types were not questioned. In other words, if it was a grant, if it was a contract, if it was being brought in from another source, they didn't go back and say, wait a minute, that's got to be a frozen position, because even though we've got more grant funds that are coming in for the excuse me, the ongoing cost increases that the grant giver, the grantor, recognized may be an additional cost source, at that particular point, we couldn't then expend it because of the wage freeze, which basically at this point, the wage freeze was a legislative wage freeze. It was a part of the Ten Suggestions, not part of the Ten Commandments, if you will.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative. I think with regards to the opinion, I'll ask Jim if he can chase that down and see if that was a written opinion from the Attorney General, and if it is, if you could get us a copy of that, I would appreciate it.
I think perhaps the Legislative Fiscal Office has a complete history of that, and certainly their position was seriously undermined at that particular point, as I recall, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate that background, and maybe what it does show us is that if that's the case, maybe what we need to do is actually put it into the statutory bills when we pass the budgets out, as opposed to putting information like that into budget notes. We just say to heck with the budget notes and start doing it the other way.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I would say that would be done at your own peril, at an agency's own peril. Because if the budget note suggests that this is what is to be done, then they thumb their nose, that particular agency were to thumb their nose at the legislature,
And given a different time frame and given a different governor, then I can see that that would be done at their own peril. But also, we did not specify the fund types at this particular time, and I can see that an agency, for instance, I've sat here through Sandy's presentation, and I've wondered about Oregon Health and Sciences University. I know that they were involved in a number of new projects, bringing on new scientists from all over the world to come to work at Oregon Health Sciences. Did we offer them more money than what other scientists working in that field at Portland, at the Portland campus, were making? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm going to guess that we probably had to offer them based upon what that they were making in Geneva or what they were making at major Eastern Ivy League universities to come back and bring their research staffs with them to Oregon. Oregon, and that process, as a result of the Oregon Health and Sciences University, is quickly becoming one of the top recognized research universities in the world. Mm-hmm. And we were able to do so because we had the resources available to us through grants and contracts. And we're able to extend that. And I don't need to ask you folks to run out and start taking a look at Oregon Health and Sciences. Again, that's an agency that has been peeled off in that process. And it's part of the same peel off that I had perceived that the Oregon University system had been given back in 1999 and previously. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. A couple of questions that I would like to ask Sandy. In the summary section here, it was stated that, and you identified also in your testimony about the $810,000 increased costs as a result of questionable raises. My question is how much of an increase in payroll is going to occur beyond this biennium now, the current biennium that we're in, because of that increase?
Chair Crummell, yes, we took it over this two-year frozen period, but yes, if someone had received an increase, then that increase, of course, you know, possibly, I don't know that this would be the case, though, if they received another increase after the freeze, they would still be that much higher again, so that would carry forward. But what we did is we limited our review to what this would cost over this biennial period. That seemed the appropriate thing to do.
Okay. So what you're anticipating is that there is a roll-up cost for future bienniums. Would you venture to guess what those roll-up costs would be on a percentage basis? I mean, would you anticipate being at, you know, 3% of biennium, 8% of biennium, 37%?
Chair Crummell, I wouldn't want to make a statement like that without doing some more work.
Okay. With regards to the payroll system coding and the issues that you found there, is that by any chance something that when you were looking at that, you found that does the Oregon University system do that process themselves, or is that a process that they ask that Department of Administrative Services, oh, I caught myself there, Department of Administrative Services to do for them?
Chair Crummell, the university system has their own system. It's the banner system. What we found is that, you know, they're very decentralized in how they operate. And so what we found is that the coding, and they have a lot of codes for some of the different payroll increases and types. And I can see where it would be pretty confusing sometimes on maybe what to code something as. And what we found is, though, that there is differences in how an event, a same or a like event, may be coded within, let's say, a department in a university and a department in another university. We also found, though, like events within the same department even as being coded differently. So, you know, that's kind of troublesome if you're trying to look at the data and say that everything that's coded under merit, special merit, is that without really looking at the documentation, the backup. And we did spend a significant amount. It was a significant amount of work. I mean, our auditors had to go out to the individual departments and review documentation often to be able to do an adequate and appropriate job.
Okay. Okay, thank you. You identified some employees who had not been frozen, whose salaries had not been frozen, and they were granted raises and that sort of thing, were there. So I'm going to anticipate then that there were other employees whose salaries were in fact, salaries or wages were in fact frozen. And generally speaking, what groups was it that were frozen?
Chair Kremel, the groups that were frozen, really it was the unionized staff. There had been a contract with the larger union, SEIU, and I hope that doesn't cost me a dollar here. Okay. union that in there, it was negotiated into their new contract that the pay freeze would not take effect until September. So September 16th. So that is when, for that group of employees, the freeze took effect. So those would be the groups that would have been covered on that. And also, too, there was, if I recall correctly, and I would want to verify this again, but there was, I believe, some information technology people, too, that were included in that, that they had a recognized service date changed to that time period. So, and they're frozen wouldn't have taken effect until September 16th.
So did you find that if the freeze didn't take effect until September 16th, did you find salary or wages being increased prior to September 16th so that when September 16th rolled around, it was in fact the new rate that was being paid to an employee versus the old rate?
Chair Kremel, what we did is we did have a few, but only a few really, that we selected and looked at of the classified staff. And we did have a few that we questioned because they were more extra meritorious increases. And those would be things over and above any regular salary merit type increases. If it was something that was a regularly scheduled merit increase, we did not question it. If it was prior to September 16th, it was covered by the union contract, and we looked at that as being appropriate under those circumstances.
Okay.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, just an explanation is they're on a little bit, some of the staff at the university system is on a little bit different annual scale, so that September 16th is the beginning of their contract year.
Right.
And that's why they have a little different timing.
Okay. Had you looked at all eight, we have eight campuses in Oregon, right? Okay.
Seven
campuses.
Chair Kremel.
Although if you put OHSU in there, then it makes it. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? I lose count after three. How much more do you think would have been identified in terms of salary increases that were granted that maybe were questionable had all seven or eight campuses been looked at as opposed to just Oregon State and University of Oregon?
Chair Cromo, I wouldn't really want to try to project that because of the data problems. As an auditor, we're kind of picky about this sort of thing, that we would want to be able to make a projection that we felt comfortable with and that we felt accurate. So I really wouldn't be able to say off the top of my head how much of that would be appropriate or not. I think, you know, given that the data coding problems, if we could have projected it, that would have been one scenario. Other than that, you know, we would have had to do a lot more extensive review of documentation. And it, like I said, it did take a long time. You know, it takes a lot of work to get at the bottom of these things. And so we definitely wouldn't have. We'd been auditing for a long time.
Do you suppose that because in the audit report here it talks about, if I can find it here, actually it's under the agency's response, and I maybe should ask them this question, but I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyway. On page 5, in the first paragraph there, the agency's response, and it talks about about a third of the way down to that first, no, two-thirds of the way down that first paragraph. It says, as a result of awarding these increases, the U of O received additional outside funds from the granting entities. My question, though, is what cost is there, and I understand as far in terms of the personnel, but what cost is there for either matching funds from the state or for non-matching, and not even matching funds, but just funds that needed to be expended, that because of an increase in facilities or increase in necessary equipment when a researcher is brought in that respect. Any idea?
Chair Crummell, I'm not sure I understand your question exactly. I'd like to see if I'm understanding it. Is what you're asking is whether or not there are some matching funds that resulted from those
professor
research grants?
And maybe I'm asking the wrong person. Maybe it's the university system that I need to be asking this of. When a professor comes in, mm-hmm. and is recruited and hired to come and teach and be a researcher at one of our universities, you got to have a place to put them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe you got a place to put them because somebody else left, or maybe you've got a place to put them because you've, you know, changed a water closet into a lab. Been there, done that at Lewis and Clark, so I know it can be done. But my point is that there's some costs that are involved, and it can be equipment costs, it can be capital costs, it can be equipment, it can be space. There's a variety of things that can be. Are there any of these things that you identified in here, is it related at all to any kind of, are there any increased costs that are not noted in here with regards to personnel? Are they, in other words, non-personnel costs, but they're still increasing costs?
Mr. Chair, I think I got you now. We didn't look at whether the individual should have been there at all or not, and the resulting costs that came with them. What we looked at is that one individual and whether their salary increased. So that was the question cost. Not, I would assume that didn't cause an increase in their computers and lab equipment and everything else that goes with it. It was just their own personal salary. So it wasn't a question of whether that instructor should have been there at all or not. It was okay. Assuming that they are there,
and that's fine.
For the additional cost.
Okay, thank you. Through this entire audit report, I basically found one recommendation, and maybe I just missed it, and that was on page 7 in the top part of the page. So if we recommend the system improve guidance on uniform coding for computerized personnel systems and documentation standards for personnel actions. Are there any other recommendations that, and I don't know if I missed them or not, but are there any other recommendations that you would have made or that should be made to help bring the Oregon University system into compliance with not only this statute but general accounting principles, principles?
Mr. Chair, most of this is an informational report. What we show you in here is the facts about what happened and the timelines about when these things happened. Nothing that happened in here we found to be illegal. But what we do look at is whether they were, we question them because whether they were kind of in compliance with that, the intent of that salary freeze.
Okay.
I did want to make one kind of point before we leave all this, too, is that it's a slightly difference between this budget note and the what Representative Butler was talking about, is that in this case, the governor was also in concurrence with that budget note. And so if there wasn't a mixed message going out, that the salary fees applied and the governor intended it to also apply to the university system.
Good. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair,
I need to
just respond to that. If I tell my sons not to steal anything and yet I go to the store and pick up candy and put it in my pocket, that sends certainly a mixed message at that particular point. So I can appreciate the fact that the governor may have been, and in fact, in August, I believe, signed that budget. So he may have said, and it was a later governor too than what we were talking about. Again, the kinds of things that we were talking about that happened immediately prior to this are what I'm looking at and saying. And then the fiscal year that was involved was the 05-07 budget year that was involved in this overall process. If they had some negotiations ongoing or some legal obligation, in at least one instance, they said, wait a minute, we actually had in performance where we were in the process of negotiation and they had turned down other employment opportunities in other universities based upon and in reliance upon the fact that we were in negotiation for this higher salary, I'm going to be in a very tough position legally to come back, and because if we don't spend it in salary, we're going to spend it in legal fees at that particular point. So I'm anxious that if there were ongoing negotiations with some of these professors and other people, and again, as money was being offered, in many instances, these were not general funds, and that's what the governor was attempting to protect, was the general fund issue. These were grants and other contracts, which were enhanced and increased to pay the compensation in some instances, as the report gives. So it's a whole series of mixed messages, and that's why I say it was a different governor. But the foundation had already been shook with the prior governor saying, these don't have the force and effect of law to me. I'm the chief executive officer. And in effect, we've got a chancellor at that point who could have just as easily said, wait a minute, I'm the chief executive officer over the universities, and we've been cut loose from these, and these aren't general funds. So I can certainly see how there could be a mixed message being sent.
Interesting idea. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler. Just for clarification, I'd like to clarify, though, about the research grants, that of these departmental ones that we did see of the increases, the ones that were the research grants was one piece of that. It wasn't all of them.
Right.
In fact, this was over at the University of Oregon. There was approximately $135,000 for 2 years that we found as questionable. So that's, you know, I just wanted to clarify that it wasn't all of them that
there was a piece of
that. And I
recognize, Mr. Chair, that this wasn't all of the monies that were involved here, that the universities, I think, and Kathy, you and Sandy will know, and certainly university folks here would know, but of the total amount of funding that we provide for the universities as part of the general fund, then you've got to look at how much they're bringing in, and it's probably 7 or 8 to 1 that they're receiving funds from the outside. We're putting in 1. The outside funds are coming in at the rate of 7 or 8 times that amount. So they're looking at that and saying, are we expending these tainted funds that have general fund with it for this particular position? And Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to defend any of the actions. I'm saying that in light of the whole circumstances that surround this at that particular time, I can see that there might have been some question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you.
Sometime ask me how I feel about this subject.
Okay, when we have more time, I will. Kathy, what was the cost of this audit?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that with me, but I can get it for you.
Okay, and do you know the amount of time, Sandy, that you spent on this audit, that you and the staff spent performing this audit?
Let's see. We've got on the our field work time period. This is the end of the check.
Chair Crummell, scope and methodology section comes in handy.
Yeah. We conducted the field work on this audit. We had two staff auditors and an in-charge that did most of the audit work on this. The field work was conducted between March of 2004 and July of 2004. I could get you the total hours and all those involved, but I don't have that with me today. But that at least gives you an indication of the time period that was involved in that.
Okay.
And that was the staffing. There was a couple of times we used another staff person to help out when we were going and doing some interviews and stuff at some of the universities. However, for the most part, we had that would be 3 full-time, basically, staff for the most part working on this audit.
Okay, so a couple of this audit was the result of a hotline tip, correct? I would like you to just send to Jim, and he can distribute it to the committee just an outline of the amount of time that was, the amount of staff time that was spent on this from beginning to end, from the time that you initially decided or got the tip to the full conclusion, and then the cost. And if my memory serves me correctly, because I also listened to the Joint Legislative Audits Committee session on this particular audit, but if my memory serves me correctly, your office spent about $147,000 on this project, and I will tell you that I do have some concerns about that. Okay, I would like to have the university folks come up, and my understanding is that Patricia Snopkowski, is that right, is going to come up, and Or Mr. Bryant, would you like to just come up and tell us who you're going to have, who all is going to come and join you for this? And while you're sitting down, just so you understand, acronyms cost you money.
And I do need a clarification of that policy. My name's Neil Bryant, and I'm an attorney from Bend, Oregon, and I'm a consultant for the Oregon University System. And so that means, people ask me what that means, and I said I now have to register as a lobbyist. And so I've gone from attorney to politician to lobbyist. And you see that I have that in it.
It's going steadily downhill.
But it's a pleasure to be here. On the acronym policy, I learned the hard way in 1999. I appeared in front of a Ways and Means Subcommittee. I think Representative Butler was either the chair or at least in charge. And within my introductory remarks, I owed $3. So as I understand it, then, any time an acronym is used, it's a dollar.
At this committee, it's only a quarter. But we can make it a dollar in your case if you'd like.
With the tough economic times, I'm surprised that it hasn't increased. But once it's explained, then you can use the acronym in the future.
It's the written rule. So
the written rule.
Once you've used the full name, then you can use the acronym.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Today, I have various people that can answer your specific questions, but if I can make some general comments first. We have Lorraine Davis, who's the Vice President of Academic Affairs at the University of Oregon. Mark McCambridge, who's the VP for Finance Administration at Oregon State. And they're the individuals who were in charge of the process of reviewing employees during 2002-2003, making contractual obligations, making decisions after discussions with deans, etc. And they've been involved in the audit since it began. And then Patty Stokowski, who's the internal auditor for the Oregon University System. And I was happy to hear the Secretary of State saying that she's a very good auditor and does a good job. So we're prepared to answer your questions. I also appeared and spoke at the Joint Legislative Audit Committee meeting in December, so I've had an opportunity to testify before on this issue. And the central point is this. The law says that this is effective as of July 1st, but the subcommittee passed the amendment saying that on May 27th. And clearly, in reading the law and the budget note, it's effective as of July 1. And, of course, we all know it was signed in August 29th by the governor and passed by the House and the Senate on August 26th. The Secretary of State takes a position, well, you should have major decisions as of May 27th then, and that should have been communicated immediately to all seven campuses, and saying, basically, unless you're contractually obligated either in writing or verbally, and verbally being in question, that you shouldn't grant any increases. Instead, what happened was the universities followed the law. And the hope was that the subcommittee would change their mind, and there was lobbying to do that. In fact, at one point in June, they were hopeful that they had the votes to make exceptions to the salary freeze for the educational system, especially for merit increases, or when professors were offered jobs from other universities outside the state where they could at least do something to try and match the offer. And so I was mentioned President Frohmeyer's discussion with the faculty on June 18th of 2003, where he said we're still trying to find some exception there so that we can compete and keep our good faculty. The Oregon State memorandum that was issued, I think, June 30th, effective July 1, took the more conservative approach, and it was followed by the campuses, basically saying the game's over, to be on the safe side, it's July 1st, no more increases, and again on the conservative side, and that includes all sources of funds, even though most of the money that goes in the university system doesn't come from the general fund. In fact, less than 20%. So the system felt that it had good arguments of why there should be some exceptions for it, if not a complete exception from the state salary freeze, but they lost that argument. And as you hear the testimony, there are, we know of only two clear instances where the July 1st date was violated, and those are both mistakes, one at Oregon State, one at University of Oregon. I think the total compensation is about $2,100 and $2,400 at those respective campuses. It's our position, and we think we can substantiate it, that all the other raises that were given were negotiated and in the process prior to May 27th. And in particular, it's been mentioned both at the JLAC meeting in December and this meeting that on the 28th at the University of Oregon, approximately half of the raises were given that are the question of this audit, over 400,000. Well, that's Lorraine Davis. She's here today. On May 28th, as she did that, following her normal process, she had no idea what the subcommittee had done the day before. So you cannot imply, should not imply, that in any way there was this rush in the university system saying we've got this budget note, it's passed the subcommittee, go out and approve all your salary increases that you've got going right now to beat this deadline. That simply did not happen. Our communications from this building to the campuses to the individuals is not that good. And as I said, the hope was and the belief was that the campuses could change the legislative decision of that subcommittee. And you're all aware, too, that until that final gavel goes down and you declare sine die, things happen. Changes are made. And that's part of the process. And this is, you know, one very significant and important subcommittee. But it doesn't mean that the other 85 representatives are going to go along with that decision. So that was still something that was in the democratic process. Having said that, the system does not ignore budget notes. That's political suicide. Because you have to come back and talk to the same folks the next biennium, and you want to have a good, credible relationship. So I think they should be commended on the fact that they did follow that July 1st date. And the fact that some of the increases didn't occur until September 18th is because that's when school started. But again, they were contracted for, obligated prior to that time. Chair Crumley, you asked the question about recommendations. The recommendation about updating your coding system and having a little better software is a good recommendation. There should be more uniformity. There were mistakes on some coding. With 12,000 employees, I think you can understand that will occasionally happen. And there were inconsistent codes. And so that's a good recommendation. As a practical matter, the university system would have done that anyway because of their own internal audit process. But this certainly stimulated it, and it will cause it to occur second. But really would have helped the university system, if you're looking for additional recommendations, is to have the Secretary of State's audits make a recommendation or a finding on how the salary freeze impacted the university system. How many professors did you lose? How many grants did you lose? When you have searches for new faculty or administration, were they affected by the fact you had a salary freeze? And I think the answer to all those is yes. And so it's something that will be important, and we'll discuss it in this session. As far as the costs involved, Chair Crumley, you're correct. At the JLAC meeting, Secretary of State's office said that they had, I think it's 281 hours invested in this and $147,000 in delegated expenses and costs. The university system at that time had over 42,000 in hours related to costs for this, and of course it's been more since that time. So it's been expensive for both. I think at this time I'll stop and ask if the committee has any questions. As I said, the three individuals I mentioned are happy to answer any questions that you might have. And and Chair Crummell, you mentioned too about the grants and any, when you get a grant, are there costs that go to the university? I'd call them soft costs. It's the belief of the university system that they make money on those grants, that it actually works the other way, that it helps fund your overhead, your administration, and then you have the intangibles of attracting better faculty and better students because you have that professor and that research and that grant there. But and most of the grants are very specific on how the money's spent. You know, what percentage can go for overhead, and administration, and for wages, and for equipment and capital costs, etc. And of course, they have their own auditing requirements too that you need to follow.
Mm-hmm.
But with that, I'll stop. And happy to answer any questions or call anybody forward that you would find helpful.
Well, let me ask you this, Neil. Do any of the other three have a statement that they want to make, or are they here primarily to just respond to questions?
Just respond to questions.
Okay. Members, do you have questions for Mr. Bryant?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I had said that, folks that would ignore a budget note do so at their own peril. I didn't intend to leave the impression that somehow the Oregon University system had ignored this budget note because of the environment at that particular time. I don't think they've ever done that, and they would do so, obviously, at their own peril, and I don't think that they... intentionally would have gone about an attempt to obstruct the intent and meaning of the budget issues as were being passed down by Ways and Means at that particular point. But I appreciate this further explanation. Yes, it leaves me wondering if the audit took 281 hours of professional time at a price tag of $147,000. Dollars, that's something over $500 an hour, and that's just on the part of the Secretary of State's office. And as I've reviewed again the policy option packages, there are significant numbers of auditors plus one attorney being added, and then other professional services, and I don't know how many folks that would include, but it looks like that Secretary of State's office is using a lot of CPAs in relationship, a lot of chiefs in relationship to the number of support staff. And having come from a small CPA firm, each CPA would normally be supported by three, four professional staff members, and then a component of other staff. So I just would question that as a part of the overall process of how they allocate resources to these budgets to do the reviews that they're doing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. I guess there's one. I'm looking at my notes here real quick. I think there's one thing that I think is kind of apparent, and that is, and I guess this is more of a statement as opposed to a question. But I will give you the opportunity to respond. I think it's a matter of semantics. And while on a separate issue, I'm concerned about the report from the Secretary of State's office, and we will take that up later with the audits division and with some expectations of what the reports have and that sort of thing. But I think, you know, as I remember back to 2002, in December there was talk about there was going to need to be a salary freeze. Or wage freeze for all of our state employees. And when I hear the term all of our state employees, that means everybody. And I think it's a matter of semantics from a standpoint of when it was approved and when it was enacted and when it was and when it was effective. Granted, you know, it was effective. It was enacted in, at the end of August, signed by the governor at the end of August, but it was effective back to July 1st. We have the date of May 27th hanging out there as far as when the committee knew had basically passed the budget note. But then even before that, because in December we had incoming Governor Kulongoski talking about pay freezes. We had started talking about it was in his budget message in January. It was in outgoing Governor Kitzhaber's recommended budget, if I remember correctly. So my point is this: you knew the intention. Now, I can't argue from the standpoint of trying to keep good faculty here, and I will tell you, we have some excellent faculty at our universities, and we're very fortunate. In that respect, and we need to be able to retain those faculty members, and I can't argue against that. And if you've got to up somebody's salary so that you can keep them here, especially somebody that's bringing grant dollars in, and by the way, I would point out that we do have a professor at the, I'm not going to say her name, but we do have a professor at the University of Oregon who is very well known around the country for going and talking to people that are being recruited by universities about how to negotiate with their university. And she's evidently very good at it. I can't argue that. But what I'm concerned about and what really bothers me is that this is something that was being talked about, and I guess I do question how upfront the university system was with the Ways and Means subcommittee from a standpoint of saying, here, we have these things already in process. We can't go back on those. You've got to let us have that. But figuring out a way to negotiate that out with the Ways and Means subcommittee so that it's not something that on a hotline tip would become an issue for the Secretary of State's Audits Division to then go out and spend $150,000 to determine whether or not there were questionable activities taken. You know, if you look at this from a standpoint of roll-up costs, if you look at it from the standpoint of the cost for this biennium, it's, you know, it's $1 million, give or take a few thousand, based on the Secretary of State's audits report, and then you send that out over several biennium. You know, in the next biennium, does it turn into 1.6 million? What does it turn into beyond that? So I guess the one thing that I would say is when you're dealing with the Ways and Means Committee, if you have things that are in process, you should and you better let them know that those things are in process. You know, we're currently negotiating with this union or that group or this group of professors, or we need some flexibility because we have some professors that are up for tenure review, or we have some folks that are up for or that we're trying to negotiate with because we've got this guy over here that, you know, has been offered a position at the University of Washington or at UCLA or some other university that's trying to steal him or her away from us. Be real upfront about that, because I don't think it does anybody any good to have the resources spent on this type of thing. I will tell you, I'm tempted to ask the committee for the support to send a letter over to the Ways and Means folks, sort of outlining what I've just said. I don't know if it would be beneficial to you or to the process to do that, but I think Ways and Means should be made aware of what we're finding on this. And so I don't know if that is those are my concerns, and I think that I would encourage you to make sure that you're upfront with everybody on that.
the JLAC committee had on as members Representative Morgan, who of course chaired the education subcommittee, and also Senator Devlin, who's the new chair of the education subcommittee. So they heard this same report and our same response, and so they're well aware of the issues. My sense is, and again, I wasn't there in 2003, but from the response in particular of Representative March and Representative Morgan, that although the budget note was on that date, that they realized things were in process. You have 12,000 employees, you have this university system that begins asking its deans, who do you retain, who do we do searches for, what salary increases, that begins in the fall and follows through, and as Representative Butler mentioned, you have professors that are wondering if they're going to stay here, should they go somewhere else, so you make commitments. So I have a sense that the subcommittee knew those things had been going on, were going on. And probably that's one good reason why they said July 1. So some of those things could be completed. If they really wanted it to be May 27th or May 28th or June 1, they should have put that in the budget note. So I sense, and this is just a sense, that the reason it went to July 1 was, one, that's the end, of course, of the fiscal year and the biennium, but two, that allowed universities to complete what they're doing in their normal process during that time. So from the response of Representative Morgan, Senator Devlin, and Representative March, who was an ex officio member, I think, of the Education Subcommittee, they didn't seem surprised by what had happened.
Okay.
We need to have good communication, and you can bet it's going to happen this time more so, in more detail than in the past, just so that there is that clear understanding. Of course, the governor's budget is not recommending a freeze this time, and I haven't heard anybody else suggesting a freeze in higher education. But one of the things we worked on in the interim is improving our communication skills with the legislature and their staffs.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Let me ask you this. Would the committee support the chair sending a letter over to Ways and Means with regards to what we have discussed today?
I think, Mr. Chair, that any of the findings which we can add to those of the JLAC that have already met and discussed this, any of those additional findings would certainly be appropriate to mention to the Ways and Means process.
Okay.
I'd agree with what Representative Button said.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to add one note. I'm certainly very sympathetic to the fact that, you know, as far as retaining good staff, and I just wanted to comment to this committee, and I think that also applies to our state agencies, and one of the concerns I have is the fairness issue. And we've asked state employees for 3 years to have a pay freeze. We have a lot of qualified personnel. Many are scientists. I know I have worked for many years with many of our state employees that I know feel very challenged by the fact that we've had a pay freeze for 3 years for them. And we face many of the same challenges, I think, retaining good employees at our state agencies, because competition from private sector or other public agencies that I do know offer higher salaries than what we can offer our state employees. So I certainly am sympathetic, but I also think it's a fairness issue that we need to be cognizant of for our other state agencies that have been facing a 3-year pay freeze.
Agree. Okay. Point noted.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I will draft a memo then to send over to Ways and Means and get that circulated to the committee members and before it is.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Bryant. Thank you also to the university staff that made the trek up here. And if you're sure you don't want to say anything, I can tell by the smiling faces who they most likely are. Or I think by the
well, and at any time, if you need questions answered, please call. And if I'm in Bend, call me in Bend too, and I'll find the answers for you.
We will do that. Thank you. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the audit. And also, if there being nothing else for us to take up at this point, I'm going to adjourn the committee. We're standing.